Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
When you love meat, you find a way to take it with you everywhere you go, especially when it comes to getting outdoors. That's why Smithfield has so many high-quality, delicious meats that are perfect for any outdoor adventure. Whether the park you're headed to is a national park or just the one down the street, like Smithfield marinated roasted garlic and cracked black pepper fresh pork tenderloin, expertly seasoned for on-the-go flavor, or prime fresh smoked ham that'll have you building on-the-go sandwiches packed with flavor. Smithfield Extra Meaty Back Ribs bring hand-selected perfection to the backyard. And Smithfield Anytime Favorites will help you take the ham you savor to the places you love. From diced ham that'll turn any picnic into an outdoor feast, to hickory smoked boneless ham steaks that are the perfect cap to any hike. The great outdoors just got greater with Smithfield. For the love of meat.
As a fresh post-collegiate athlete, I really had no direction in my training for the first time in about a decade. Every rep I had done had been for a purpose and toward a certain outcome. Then I just became an average gym goer, and I needed to find something to keep me focused and working hard with purpose. I came across a variation of CrossFit's main site programming called CrossFit Football, so I was naturally intrigued. They soon changed the name to Power Athlete, and the programming that I was doing, called Johnny Wad, was fun, brutal, and it was giving me great results. The creator of this program is my guest today, John Wellborn. Prior to diving into the performance coaching realm, John was a veteran NFL lineman. His method and his podcast, Power Athlete Radio, played a huge part in my development as a coach and what you see now as Nomad Strength. In our conversation, John and I talk about the old CrossFit football days, his experience competing in the NFL, and his experience competing in the second ever CrossFit Games in the middle of an offseason. What was his mindset as an athlete of needing to be selfish to be successful? We also got into a bunch of fun movie and music conversations and a ton more. Before we dive in, I want to make note that the new Nomad Strength program, 30-Day Minimalist, is available now and is linked in the show notes. This is a kettlebell-only program to give you efficient and effective workouts to get the most out of your training when you don't have a lot. Check out the program and also get a bunch of access to my training playlist and a bonus section of a collection of my favorite easy minimalist recipes as well. So now let's dive back into the action with John Wellborn of Power Athlete. Everybody, welcome back to the Nomad Strength Show. Today, I am joined by John Wellborn, Power Athlete HQ, former NFL player, been involved in the training and performance space for a really long time. And I remember the old CrossFit football stuff. That was where I came in. I was in college right when you guys were doing the CrossFit football stuff, right when it was kicking off. So that was like my first introduction. And it's pretty funny, like basically ever since then, I do usually one or two kind of blocks every year where I'll hop back on Johnny Wad for a few months at a time. And so nice. it's just like my favorite stuff to just go blast and crush myself for a few months at a time. It's kind of like the mental/gut check I need every year. But man, thanks for making time. I'm excited to dive in some stuff today.
Cool. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so I want to go into kind of the performance stuff first, because there's a lot of non-training stuff and pop culture things I want to ask you about, because okay. Like music and movies and stuff I want to have some fun with. But if we get into the training stuff first, you know, you're a former NFL player, had a pretty lengthy career by what I would consider like NFL standards, right? I mean, they throw out that number that the average is, what, like 2 or 3 years or something like that for the average guy in the NFL, and you played for quite a while. So was the performance part of it where now you're thinking of how do I always enhance my performance, get better? Were you looking at it from like a coaching standpoint while you were playing also in yourself? Like, did you kind of take on that self-experimentation idea?
No, not at all. I was really fortunate to have some amazing coaches around me. Trained with a guy named Rafael Ruiz, who, when I started CrossFit football, he came out on the road and actually taught with me and taught all the sprint stuff, just because he's still to this day one of the best strength coaches I've ever been around. So I thankfully just handed my future and what I was doing for my training for whatever Rafael wanted us to do. And so it was great. And I just got to show up. This is the time I was here. I got to plug in, work with one of the world's best strength coaches, and we had an incredible training group. When I, you know, like, you hear all these cliches, like the strength of the wolf is the pack and all this other fucking bullshit. But when I started training with Raf, we had about 3 other NFL guys that were training. A couple years later, fast forward, that we had about 25 to 30 NFL guys training. So we really became known for guys that were getting after it. If guys wanted to be the best and they wanted to train, they came to Tampa and they trained with Rafael and myself, and we put together an incredible training group. And from that, it created such a crucible of performance that by the time we got done and ready to go back to our respective teams, everybody's game was so far elevated that there was nothing we were going to do in training camp or through the regular season that was as hard or as difficult as demanding of what we'd done within that training space. So I really realized the value of having an incredible team of individuals around me. And because I didn't train, not one season did I, or one off season did I train with any of the teams that I was employed by.
Oh, wow.
So I did not get an off season workout deal. Most of the guys I played with had these exorbitant off season workout deals where they get $1 million to train in the off season. Those cheap fuckers never gave me one. So they were like, well, we know you're always going to come in shape. Why are we going to pay you for this? And I'm like, because it's nice to make extra money. And right. They never offered me an off-season workout deal. So my deal was, if you're not going to pay me to be there in the off-season, I'm not going to choose to live there.
Right.
So
And this was when you were, was this like the entire, because you played for a few different,
I played,
different teams. Was that the situation across all of them?
Yeah, I played for 10 years. They didn't give me an off-season workout deal in Philly. So I went down and trained in Florida with Roth. And then when I went to the Chiefs, I trained that first year with Roth. And then I ended up selling my house, didn't want to go back to Florida, and went back out to California where I'm from and started training Athletes Performance. So I trained with Verstegen and those guys in Athletes Performance and did that for a number of years.
Was the stuff that you guys were doing in those training camps, did that, I mean, I'm sure it did to a degree, but how much of that influenced kind of how you ended up creating the model of Power Athlete and before CrossFit football?
Oh, it's carbon copy. Yeah, I mean, I'm an autistic parrot in that respect. You know, I would not ask somebody to do something that I did not do myself.
Yeah.
So a lot of what you see with a lot of, I mean, so Power Athletes always use a lot of post-activation potentiation training. That was the majority of my training in the NFL. Do something heavy, do something fast. You know, bring Caldeets into the mix, and now all of a sudden we're using more, you know, French contrast, and there's more triphasic, and now we're focusing more on, you know, eccentrics, concentrics, and isometrics, which we had always put into the program. So when I first met Cal Dietz and he presented me triphasic, those pieces were, hold on, are we still with you?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, hold on. Okay, cool. Yeah, so those pieces of triphasic made a ton of sense to me and how he was doing it, because we had always been very PAP-based. And so now all of a sudden, you know, do something heavy, do something fast, do something dynamic, and all the different pieces that he started incorporating was really very familiar, and how he was arranging it was really interesting. So much so that when he presented it, I went and wrote my own version of triphasic based upon what I had done. And he looked at it and he's like, wow, like, this is pretty amazing that this is what you've been doing for your training. So, you know, we used a lot of accentuated negatives, a lot of manual resistance, whereas those had always been a huge factor in the training, whereas he was using them more with barbells. I mean, it was really just interesting to see his training and then, you know, my variation of it that we had created with Roth. You know, so what you guys see in Power Athletes' various programs is steeped in this Power Athlete methodology that was forged over, you know, a number of years, not only starting in college, working with a guy named Todd Rice, who's the Busa brothers, Nick and can't remember the other brother. He's pretty much their dad hired him. He was our strength coach in college. He's their private strength coach. So, I mean, you know, plyometrics, jumps, Olympic lifts. I mean, everything that we had done in college. And then when I went to the NFL, ended up, you know, training that first year with the Eagles and then going down to Tampa, meeting Raphael. And, yeah, that's what our training looked like. So what you guys get to see, and really that methodology was really crafted over about 15 years.
So when you go to bring that to CrossFit, like at the time, this was still the early days.
Yeah.
Like the suit, and you competed in the, was it the very first one or was it the second
one?
Games?
Yeah. So I was training at Athletes Performance. And for those of you guys that know Southern California, I was living in Newport Beach and I was driving to Carson, which is a terrible drive. It's not far. It's about 29 miles, but it could be anywhere from 29 minutes to, you know, 4 hours. So I would drive out there about 2 or 3 days a week. And then I started going down to this gym that had bumper plates down in South Orange County. And I did a Google search and a CrossFit gym popped up like 3 blocks from me that had bumper plates. So I went in there and talked to the owner and said, hey, can I train here a couple days a week? I'll lift some weights and like to, you know, snatch, clean and jerk and plyos and jumps. And that was kind of how I got indoctrinated in the CrossFit deal. And I was still training for the NFL. Going to Athletes Performance, training at this place, you know, training a couple others. And then they reached out and asked if I'd do this thing called the CrossFit Games. I was like, yeah, fuck it. I'm not under contract with anybody. My contract had ended with the Chiefs, and I was looking for a new contract. So a week before training camp opened, I went up and did the CrossFit Games. I'm sure I'll show up and win this fucking thing at like 312 pounds. I'm like just a hair under 6'6". And it was such a spectacle that they ended up filming the whole thing and making a documentary. It's on Netflix called Every Second Counts.
And that those first two, especially like when you look at the movement itself, and I mean movement like the way that the guys were moving, doing all of these exercises that now are just like the staples of CrossFit. Yeah. And at the time they were still, but the way that these dudes were moving, you're just like, how is this the guy that made it to the games at the time? And you're like, you don't realize how much of its infancy it was in at that time. Like all of these movements were brand new to everybody essentially that had not done them, coming from like a sports performance background like you, where like, yeah, I've done snatch and clean and jerks and like all these high explosive movements forever. And then these other guys are like, yeah, I can snatch 135. And then you see the video of like Jason Kalipa at the games. And this was even when they had it at the stadium.
Yeah.
And they're doing that snatch workout and he's like falling over and throwing the bar. And it's like, what is happening?
It was a different time. Very, very different time to say the least. But I had never done CrossFit. You know, we trained at a CrossFit gym, but I had done my training, obviously, to go play in the NFL. And just having to deviate a little bit to add some movements like muscle ups and handstand push ups and some of these more CrossFit specific movements took me about 10 or 12 days. And then they showed up and filmed the Every Second Counts. And then I showed up and it was terrible. I was super tired, came home 7 days later, had a tryout with Baltimore Ravens, came home, Patriots called, and then I went out there and ended up getting hurt in the last game, or the last, or it was actually like the second to last play of the last preseason game. I'd gone in and played early, and for those of you guys who know NFL, last preseason game usually just young guys. So I went in and played first series, two series, took my stuff off, was chilling. I mean, I think we had like a hot dog on the sideline. One of the young guys gets hurt and they need somebody to go in. I like my shoulder pads are off, I got no tape on, and I was kind of the odd man out because, you know, obviously a lot of the starters had already been there for a long time, even though I was a veteran. I was new. So the coach goes, get back in there. After sitting around for a couple hours, go back out and plant. And I felt a crunch in my knee and actually had sheared off a piece of bone off my kneecap and got stuck in the joint. And
holy cow.
I was like, fuck. And so I didn't say anything, came home. You know, I'd never been cut, started my whole entire NFL career. So I figured I'd just deal with it and say something after the first game. About 2 minutes to the final, you know, 3:58, 2 minutes before the final bell for the cut, they called me and said, hey, we got to release you, but we're going to re-sign you tomorrow. So got released, came back the next day to get re-signed. They put me back through the physical, found the chip in my knee and couldn't sign me, so I came home and had surgery.
Oh, dang.
And was just rehabbing, chilling on the couch, and that's when CrossFit hit me up, and Glassman asked me if I would come help them develop their tech on how to train athletes. And it was the first time somebody had actually discussed training in terms of a technology. I thought it was fascinating. Sure. And then 30 days later, we launched CrossFit Football.
And so when you're bringing the methodology that you were going to eventually turn into CrossFit Football, like, what was the appeal for Glassman to bring you guys in for that? Like, why did he think that was, because that was like at the time, and I can't remember what you guys had, like the acronym, because like Brian McKenzie was doing endurance, mm-hmm. and there's like the couple other ones that had like kind of that niche specialty CrossFit whatever.
Yeah. So
what was the appeal there for him?
The pitch was he wanted to bookend CrossFit. He wanted to do endurance. He wanted CrossFit mm-hmm. in the middle for general fitness, and he wanted sport specific to try to teach people how to use CrossFit movements to train for power sports. So gotcha. He was trying to cover this spectrum, and I have the rare distinction of having the only, I guess, owner-requested, licensed version. My own version of CrossFit. So CrossFit Endurance had an endurance template that they mixed with CrossFit movements and CrossFit okay. programming. So like, hey, you're going to do your WOD, and then you're going to run 5Ks, you know, let's say, for example. And then there was yep. CrossFit. CrossFit Football was its own methodology. We lifted weights, gotcha. Forging powerful athletes. I mean, so it was it was the only time in history that, CrossFit licensed a distinct and different version of CrossFit under the CrossFit banner.
So, and at the time, it was mostly because you guys were doing, you know, progressive overload on the strength model that wasn't really involved in the main, like, workout of the day on the CrossFit site, because you never really knew what days were going to show up where you're actually trying to do any kind of strength training. It wasn't consistent. And you guys threw in that model of like, we're going to do strength training and then the WOD on the back end of it. And that like kind of became the general CrossFit model after a while.
Yeah,
like,
no,
now everybody does that.
Yeah, no, I mean, I single-handedly virally destroyed CrossFit. And yeah. I'm just not saying that as like an ego thing. Legitimately, Glassman got drunk and screamed that at me right before he went face down in the soup. What before CrossFit Football and really power athlete and John Wellborn, and I'll talk about myself in the third person on this deal. Strength was just another element of CrossFit. So there was these 10 elements of CrossFit. Strength was just a foundation, just another piece. It was like this. And I've always believed that strength is the platform at which all life is built on. A stronger person will be able to endure. To quote Mark Richto, stronger people are generally more useful and fun. I mean, harder to kill. I mean, all these things. But mm-hmm. I really believe that strength is the platform at which all life is built. So bringing standardized, periodized, well-established strength templates, dropping them into CrossFit under the guise of a strength WOD, and then mm-hmm. adding in short metabolic conditioning exercises that are 7 to 10 minutes. We found that 7 to 10 minutes was a sweet spot. Occasionally you had to get up to 12 and 15, never more than 15, but the majority were in that like 7 to 10, on occasion 3 to 5, and then varying through these short intensity, you know, heavy, hard, fast, a little bit of conditioning, coupling that with smart, you know, strength training, ended up producing some really phenomenal results. And so much so that every CrossFit gym you go to has some strength element involved. So, I remember Glassman screaming at me, you know, you virally destroyed CrossFit. You convinced everybody they needed to be strong, and I can't walk into a CrossFit gym without some form of, you know, strength template, and that's your fault. And I was like, well, I'm glad I was able to save this many people and convince everybody that being strong is really fucking fun.
Like, if that's my fault, I'm going to be okay with that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'll gladly wear that coat. If you want to put that on a jacket, I'll wear that forever. I mean, it's very rare to say that the largest fitness movement in history, which is responsible for putting more barbells in people's hands than anybody else on the planet, that mm-hmm. I was able to alter the trajectory and change it in a positive way. So right. much so that, you know, I mean, it's, you know, for all Greg Glassman's idiosyncrasies and, shortcomings, let's say, to be nice, it's disingenuous to deny his influence on barbells and strength training and just general fitness. I don't think, you know, and I'd say probably that coupled with like the movie 300, Mark Twight. I mean, really like this perfect storm of Facebook starting, the movie 300, CrossFit, the whole deal. I mean, I remember I was, you know, in the NFL and the movie 300 comes out. I saw it, literally walked out and walked right back into the same movie that was starting and watched it twice back to go. And I was like, this is the fucking best thing I've ever seen. you know, because for the most part, strength and this physical culture had been so, you know, not demonized for so long, but you're kind of viewed as a bit of a weirdo. I mean, you know, I would go places and I'm just under 6'6" at, you know, during my NFL career, I was pretty consistent, you know, right around 10% body fat, sub 10% body fat. So I walked around with 270, 280 pounds of lean muscle, and people would literally stop and thought you were a fucking weirdo. After the movie 300, it completely changed. People started asking, what do you do for your training? I want to be like those dudes in the movie 300. So I think CrossFit hit this perfect storm of like Facebook, YouTube, training, you know, girls lifting weights, the movie 300, and it was kind of a perfect storm. So the fact that I was able to have my place in that, hopefully in that folklore, is pretty amazing.
You bring up that movie, and it is such a, it was, it's so weird how, because, so to give you an age range here, so I was born early 90s, right? I'm 31. So I was in high school when that movie came out, and I think I was like a, I was a junior or something like that in high school. And that movie, I remember like we kind of all had the same reaction. There wasn't a movie yet for us anyways, that was like, that made me want to go train and get huge. You know what I mean? And I'm thinking there was this like maybe 15, 20 year gap where there were really no movies like that. Like, cause the ones before that were all like, you know, the Arnold and Sly in the '80s and Commando and Predator and all that kind of stuff. Did those have that kind of same, I don't know, like cultural impact on training that like that 300 did at that moment? Did they do the same thing back in the '80s in that way?
I don't think so. Maybe a little bit. This is kind of a random kind of a memory, but I was 10 years old, maybe 11, and I grew up in Southern California near the beach, Palos Verdes, Torrance, Manhattan Beach, Redondo Beach. And when you're about 9, 10 years old, there's this deal called Junior Lifeguards, and it's a summer program, and you pretty much go in, and you're kind of a lifeguard apprentice, and you go through this, you know, you start at a C, and you get to a B, and you get to an A, and the idea is by the time you turn 18, you end up taking your lifeguard test, and then you're a lifeguard. So it's this kind of a lifeguard apprentice program, and it's fucking great. We would go, we would wake up, and then we would go to the beach and go surf, and then it would start at like noon, and we would be at junior lifeguards until like 4, and then we would surf, and our moms would come pick us up like 5. So you spent the entire day at the beach for the whole summer. We were doing like, I think it was first aid at one of the lifeguard stations. So they had these, you know, these like mannequin dummies, and we would work on first aid and, you know, learn how to like, you know, bandage people up and CPR and shit. And all of a sudden we were like there at the aid station and like all of a sudden, and there's like a huge boardwalk, you know, kind of like a big concrete pad where people ride their bikes and walk. There's like a riot going on, and like people are like screaming and like, ah, and this, and we see this like disturbance, and we think that somebody might have fallen in this, and we're like, you know, junior lifeguards, we're going to go over there and save these people. So we like run out there and we're watching, and all of a sudden we realize that it's not a riot, that nobody's hurt, that there's a dude walking on the strand, on the boardwalk, on this like area, and people are gasping, like it's literally like the seas of, you know, are parting, and it's like a fucking riot. And we're like watching, and all of a sudden we see these people part, and this dude just comes walking, and he's wearing like a set of like short shorts, like dolphin shorts, and he's wearing a tank top. He looked like a superhero. He looked like a Marvel character, big chest, and he's wearing a gold chain. Like his chest was so big, he could have like sat like a Coke can on top of the front of his chest. Yeah. And he's just strutting, and he's wearing like these kind of like football shoes, like boot, like almost like high tops. And we're just like, who is this? And we see him walk by. And that was Lyle Alzado. If you guys know the Raiders, Lyle Alzado, like if you guys Google him, look him up. He looked like a fucking Marvel character. And we watched him walk, and we kind of followed him. And then there was this long, like maybe 60-yard big ramp up to the parking lot. And he basically ran it up and down like 10 times while people stood and watched. And it was pre-cell phones, pre-cameras. Like nobody had a camera or anything. Just people were just like, I mean, NFL player, he was big. I mean, if you guys look him up, he was jacked. You know, this is kind of in those performance-enhancing days. And he looked like a $1 million, man. And I remember thinking, like, I want to lift weights.
Yeah.
And when I got a chance to go to high school, I was super skinny. I mean, I had, like, a neck like this. And my brothers were all big and strong. And I knew that, like, big, strong people, like, tended to be around these weights. I didn't necessarily know what they did with them. I just thought that maybe like you got big through osmosis by just being around them. I just knew that like I would be big and strong if I went where those weights were and where those other big and strong people were. So that was kind of the push for me to start lifting weights. I wasn't super strong the first day. I got underneath and started lifting weights, but I knew that with like consistency and effort, like eventually these things would happen. And it ended up happening. And I think by the time I was a junior, sophomore and junior, you know, I had a bunch of scholarship offers. And by the time I was a senior, I had a bunch more and got a chance to go play college football, continue to lift weights and train. And, you know, that ended up turning into 10 years in the NFL.
That's awesome. Do you think that the, like the movies and the, you know, the mythology around guys like that and in the 80, whether it's Arnold, whether it's those guys that we played or whether it's the 300 guys, I don't know that there's much. I mean, they do the superhero Marvel thing is forever, right? Like that's kind of, I think we're at the point where that's just going to be, there's 40 movies every year now, right?
What's wild is, I mean, I saw Predator, I saw Schwarzenegger, I saw Pumping Iron. I wanted to lift weights and be in good shape because, you know, like I wanted to play football. I wanted to be all these things. And so it was important to me, but I don't remember it being as impactful. Like, I don't remember, I mean, Pumping Iron was a little different. I mean, obviously that was, you know, before my time. I was pretty young when that came out. But like, I remember seeing Predator and all the different Stallone and all these movies and like they were in good shape and like, you know, it never influenced, but for some reason, and I don't know what it is, when the movie 300 came out, it was like an atom bomb where all of a sudden people that like weren't into lifting weights or weren't into training, all of a sudden like wanted to lift weights and train. That people were just like, saw the way those dudes are built. And I wonder if it was like the entire package, like it was maybe the way that the movie was presented. Maybe it was the cinematography. Yeah. Maybe it was the time with CrossFit. Maybe it was social media. I don't know, like a perfect storm. But, I remember, this is pretty wild, I remember I went to go see the movie, we walked, and I went and saw it again, and there were, and I remember, God, we were in South Orange County somewhere, and there was like a bunch of office buildings, and as we were sitting there, because there was a gym down there, we went and got lunch, and I was like, oh, this movie, you know, somebody's like, you got to see this movie, so I went to go see it. The entire movie theater was packed with like 20-something younger, like maybe 20, late 20s, early, you know, something in their 20s, girls that were like either secretaries or like worked in the office buildings. So I went in there and there was like, you know, a big movie theater. And I'm in there with like a couple dudes I'm training with. And the thing was packed with all these, like, I just remember like blonde ponytails and girls in like collared shirts and suits. And I was like looking around and I was like, what the fuck? Like there was like a lot of like really like good looking professional girls that were in this deal, and they were in like packed, like somebody had said to them, and like walking out, I was like, you know, they're all wearing their like, you know, like little like blouses and sport coats and the whole deal. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like I would have never, and I, you know, I love the movie. Just like the minute that he Sparta kicked the dude in the chest and like, this is, you know, like he was fucking at us. But I just remember looking around the crowd and being like, okay, like this isn't the crowd I would expect for this. You know, Spartan story. And as you know, I was a rhetoric major at Cal, and, you know, so I was a big, reader and lover of antiquity and like, you know, you know, all that, like kind of the classic Hellenistic culture. I mean, the Spartans are written about it in this. So, I mean, I had like an interesting, not deep understanding, but I had read about like the Agoge. And so I knew the story of the Spartans and, you know, the 300 and Thermopylae, and had read all that before. So to see it kind of dramatized and put into this, you know, and like the physical culture of the Spartans put through, I mean, it just, it hit like no other movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And I think that catapulted it. And, you know, the Jim Jones thing was very cultish. I mean, hence the Jim Jones, but it was black and white. It was kind of obscure, and I know people had done it. CrossFit was much more approachable because there wasn't that many Jim Jones locations. You had to like pay to get in, and like, or not, I'm not even. You had to like write an essay to be entered in, whereas CrossFit just show the fuck up and do it. So I think it just hit it a lot. But what was interesting when I first was approached with CrossFit and sat with Glassman and those guys, and they asked me, you know, like, what do you think of CrossFit? My comment was, I think you're going to make people a lot of fit, but in terms of athletic performance, it's lacking a lot of pieces. You know, bilateral hip hinging in a sagittal plane to the point where you get sagittitis is a real problem. And if you understand athleticism, step squat and lunge, X and Y, Z axis of rotation, different planes of motion, you know, movement and the way that I understand it, basically prefacing it on bilateral hip hinging in a sagittal plane, because the inventor of the training system was a polio stricken gymnast who could not change direction, and all he could do was sagittal plane hinging. So, but yet it's also very easy to quantify and measure, you know, hinging and sagittal plane. So it's, you know, I understand how it goes. And it did, if the goal is to make people fitter based upon your definition, which is self-serving, that you're able to do more tomorrow than you did today, it makes sense.
Or faster.
Yeah, or faster. So like based upon, you know, so like Glassman's definition, increased work capacity, broad time, modal domains. Yes, the training does fit the description. Can you become fitter? The problem is like once your anthropometric ratios and all these other things stagnant, the only way to effectively become fitter and to effectively move faster is to become more efficient or stronger. You know, so eventually all roads lead to Rome. Eventually all roads lead to strength. And we found that the people that put a periodized strength training program in that was intelligent became fitter versions based on the CrossFit model.
There was a, to bring it in back into the 300 conversation, there was a, some long exchange I had seen on Twitter, like within the last week. There was some philosophy major, professor, something like that, who said on his bio, like he specializes in that time period. And, he had made the comment in like this huge long tweet thread that essentially all of these warriors that we tend to classify like the Spartans as like the most badass guys on the planet, right? He claimed throughout this whole thread that they didn't actually care about the training of their bodies as much as they did. He used the example of like, they said that a guy was only as useful to them as if he could handle what he saw in war. Wouldn't matter if he was like super ripped or super buff. And he kept using like words like that. And it gave the impression that he actually didn't have a clue about just physiology in general and what those guys probably would have looked like. Right. Cause he's just saying, it's not about that. It's not about the training. It's not about looking huge and jacked. And then one of the guys that I had seen reply, who like kind of is, he's kind of out there with a lot of things, but he's hilarious. And his comment was like, if the Spartans saw the movie 300, they would have loved, because that would have been the movie that they would have made about themselves. Yeah. Like they would have portrayed themselves exactly that way.
if you go back into antiquity, and the Spartans didn't write a lot. There's not a lot of like everything's these secondhand accounts. Like in Athens, the most coveted nannies to raise your children were Spartan women, because they raised intelligent, basically little savages. They were they were deemed like highly desirable. The stories of like, you know, if we come to Sparta, we'll kill everybody. And they just respond back with like, if. So they had really funny senses of humor, like you know, the age old, like lay down your weapons and like come and get them. Like all of that stuff is true. I mean, we know that secondhand. So the stories of the Spartans, you know, I mean, they've glamorized it. You know, in a lot of ways, you know, you were either a citizen or a slave. The citizens didn't work. Their craft was warfare, to prepare for war, and it's all they did and trained. Very similar to the samurai. You know, if you look and, you know, like one of my favorite movies is The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. I fucking love that movie. And in it, you know, he talks about their savages with sticks, and he's like, who have dedicated their life to warfare for 1,000 years. Like if your singular dedication, and like that to me is, I mean, you know, when you start talking about the best warriors ever to walk the earth, I mean, you know, the Spartans are in the you know, the samurai as they were known. Now, the historical accounts of the Ronin and were samurai really, you know, later in life, it kind of, you know, kind of obviously degraded down. But if you dedicate yourself to the task, and we've seen this, you know, if you have, I always say like, you know, hobby pursuits have hobby gains, right? If you want to have a hobby company, you're going to get hobby paychecks. So if you really want to master something and become legendary in it, you have to dedicate yourself to the point of being the most selfish individual possible. I mean, when I played in the NFL, I wasn't married, didn't have kids, and was so selfish about playing and preparation that I got up, I ate, I trained, I came home, I ate, I napped, went back and trained You know, we did all of our sport performance. We sprinted, we did everything. And if I was tired, I didn't go out. If I dated somebody and had a girlfriend and she was a pain in the ass, I got rid of her. I did everything was based on this singular pursuit, and it was extremely selfish. Now I got three kids and a wife and a business and people pulling me in a million different directions. And so you have to constantly be managing your time, trying to keep it all together, as my dad would say. But when I played, the level of selfishness was directly related to the success. So if it didn't make me better, I would wake up in the morning and weigh myself and my body weight was down. You know, I was going to either go eat and I was going to push the training a little bit, or I might back off the intensity. If something was stressing me out, I just removed it from my life. And there was no apologies for it. So even girls I dated or people I was around, I'm like, dude, if this becomes stressful or this gets outside the, you know, let's have a good time, it's just going to go away just because I don't want to fucking do it.
Was that easy for you to get to that place mindset wise? Mm-hmm. Like were you kind of, are you kind of always that way, or did that you have to kind of develop that once you got in there?
And no, I've always been able to compartmentalize. I mean, empathy is something I've developed later in life. Mm-hmm. Probably once I had kids, I probably activated the empathy gene. I didn't have any growing up. I've never felt remorse or, you know, fucking, my brother used to joke like cold as ice, like a fucking serial killer. We go out there and it's like, if you're going to line up, we're going to fucking go. So I think like empathy and sympathy and some of these emotions I've like since developed since retirement. And it's been much better. It's probably a much more rich, fulfilling life. But if you want to be good at a task, like a professional athlete, and do it for a long, long time at a high level, there's a certain level of selfishness that has to exist. And I do knew guys that were able to have families and manage businesses and do all this and play at a high level. I just wasn't that dude.
Yeah. Just needed to know how you operated to make it work. So pairing off of that, I want to ask, because you were on the team. How long were you with the Patriots?
Just one season. So I was there in training camp and then got hurt in that last preseason. Came home, had my knee scoped, and and that was the year Tom Brady ended up blowing out his knee. So that was a good year to not play for him.
Yeah, that was the year, because I was curious, like, because he obviously is one of those guys that has a million things, but he clearly wants to always be doing football, right? Like, that was he had to be doing that, and it came, you know, obviously these last few years, what it would seem at the expense of even his own family, right?
Well, and so I never comment on another person's marriage or family or career and all that, so. I just know
it would appear that that was the case.
Yeah, I know Tom personally. I went to school with his sister. We hung out socially. I knew him through, you know, obviously I'd met him many times. You know, hung out with him with Tony Gonzalez, and kind of like we flew in the same circles, and we're also very friendly when I was at the Patriots. Tom has been nothing but the nicest, most gracious, best person I've ever been around. Whenever I hear people talk shit on him, I'm just like, dude, that guy is a fucking stellar human being and an amazing dude. He was able to juggle it and play at a really high level. He hit it at a really interesting point where, you know, that 2009 CBA change completely altered the trajectory of the game. Yeah. It was kind of 3 yards in a cloud of dust and we're going to fucking bust skulls. And then you got dudes killing themselves, and then they have to do a CBA and there's a lockout and they change everything. You know, fantasy football comes in, and then it goes. The NFL goes from this, like, put your foot, hand in the dirt, and, you know, the run game is going to drive the pass game, to a pass driven offense. Where now, so we're going to pay these guys exorbitant amount of money, and we're not going to get them hurt. So, I remember when the new CBA hit. I had, you know, obviously retired in 2009, got hurt in 2008, had teams calling. I started the CrossFit thing, taught like 36 seminars that first year. And teams were like, hey, you know, we want you to come try out. And I was like, shit, man, we're already, you know, making a seven figures business. I'm teaching, traveling every weekend, trying to develop this. And you have to remember the methodology for Power Athlete, and really in terms of fostering, developing athleticism and the training programs and all the pieces of this. I did not have this when we started CrossFit Football. I remember I was just on Andy Stump's podcast. And Andy and I were sitting around the other day. He was in Austin to do, I think, Joe Rogan and another podcast. And we ended up going up and doing jits, and then went to dinner. And he was telling his wife that, you know, Glassman pitched me CrossFit Football. I was down in Coronado at Andy's on-base housing. We were sitting around drinking beers and had to come up with like 30 workouts because I had to go out to Arizona, out to Glassman, where when he was still married to Lauren, and present them this CrossFit Football methodology. which I created in real time. Like, and then they said, looks great. Launch a website. So 30 days later, we launched a website, had these workouts, used these templates that I created based off of my own training. And then they were, you know, we got 17,000 hits the first day. 2 weeks later, you're going to have to teach a seminar. Literally, like, we launched March 31st. What was it? Mother's Day weekend, which is what, in May? We did our first seminar that weekend. So between, like, March 31st, April 1st, to, like, Mother's Day weekend, which is in mid-May or towards the end of May, like, we launched, and, like, that was my first seminar. And I didn't even know what to teach at a seminar. I was taught people to lift weights, and then we watched cut-ups of, like, me playing football. I was trying to show I was trying to show people athleticism and how you move through space and this. And I thought, cut-ups, I'm an NFL player. So we said, I sit around and, like, had, like, a clicker and made people watch cut-ups of me, which is stupid. and then we just started teaching this. And what was amazing is people were like, this is great. And I'm like, this is awful. I don't even know what I'm teaching. And I remember sitting on the plane trying to come up with, like, okay, like, what's my initial talk? What is CrossFit football? What is this? What's, you know, what's the power athlete? How am I forging powerful athletes? What are these pieces? And I, you know, I was a rhetoric major. So I was an English philosophy, you know, with an argumentative approach. I was planning to go to law school. So I graduated in four, got my master's in my, or sorry, worked on my master's in education in my fifth year. And then, you know, the deal was to go play in the NFL for a few years, make some dough. And there was a law school scholarship at Berkeley for a four-year letterman called the Adrian Cragen Scholarship that I was going to apply for, and I was going to go to law school. And my dad and my brother and my other brother went to law school but never practiced. We were all going to, like, go into practice together. So that was the game plan. All of a sudden, 10 years later go by, and I'm like, you know, the CrossFit hits me up, asked me to do this. And I was like, yeah, let's give it a shot. And, like, this thing, like, materialized, and I'm – you know, I don't have a degree in physiology. I don't, like, this isn't what I went to school for. I like to lift weights. I like to train. I was inquisitive in nature. Whenever we did something, I always wanted to understand why and, like, how these pieces all fit, just because I'm, not because I'm a smartass, just because I'm curious. And had to sit down and, you know, the one thing I am good at is absorbing information and, you know, like, going through it, and just started testing different things. And imagine, you put out a free program to the world, tens of thousands of people do it, and then you travel and you meet the people every weekend doing the training program, and you get a chance to put them through a two-day diagnostic, aka a seminar. It's pretty amazing when all of a sudden I have my understandings of athleticism and sprinting and what it all looks like based upon these pieces, and I just had thousands of data points. So where Power Athlete came from, and where this whole, the reason that this thing hyper jumped and moves this fast, and why there's nobody else on the planet, maybe other than CrossFit or Kelly Starrett or some of these other people that saw more people than us. I had the ability to give away free programming, have people come, pay me to come, and then put them through a two-day event. And it's just a huge diagnostic. And see exactly what they could and couldn't do, go back, tweak the programming, new people show up, tweak it again, give them information, get them data points, started having this. I mean, it allowed me to do probably seven PhDs worth of work. My buddy Tom Newman, who's the director of performance for Mass General, he's got a bunch of PhDs, and he's like, dude, between your podcast and what you did, you have like 27 PhDs. You've done more research, more studies, put your hands on more people. And so whenever people get into this, whether it's talking about hypertrophy or training, and they want to, like, fucking go down these rabbit holes on social media, I did that in person with athletes and have trained, you know, so many people, to the point where you almost get to the point where you're like, no, we figured out this solution. I know how this piece works, and we know how to, you know, increase athleticism. We know how to build power athletes. And if people do the training, they are definitely farther along than if they didn't.
Well, not only that, but you also have however many, I mean, just hundreds, I imagine, different thousands, different pieces of content and material on all of the things that you guys discovered during that time period out already.
No, I mean, we've been pushing content for a long time to the point where I'm almost kind of shocked. But, you know, we've done, you know, obviously 700 episodes of Power Athlete Radio. I've been doing that for over 10 years, and, you know, get a chance to be on podcasts like this and hopefully, you know, push it out to different audiences. And just it's been a really fascinating, exciting, and just I feel very humbled to have had the opportunities and, you know, to have the wherewithal to understand it and be able to kind of curate this information. I've always been into patterns. I know it sounds kind of dorky and weird, but as an NFL player, You know, you watch film, you learn the plays, and plays are just really set patterns. Film is set patterns. Everything's a pattern. So you run up to line, you get in your stance, you start looking at the pattern. I know what the defense is. I know where the guy should be. I know what they're doing. I know what the down and distance. I know the play. I know how this person should react. What's different? And you start looking for, you know, the piecing and what's different in here. Now all of a sudden this guy's cheated this way. So now all of a sudden, hey, this is going to come here. And it's just basically pattern recognition. Strength training and performance training and working with athletes and all this other stuff, same thing.
Yeah.
Right. I have a theory. We have a set play. We know what I want to do. What can't you do? Why can't you do it? And more importantly, what do I have to do to allow you to do it? And then can I break these pieces apart? Can I train them separately? Can I reassemble them and make you a better version? And the training is not necessarily the test, the competition, the sport. I'm not trying to increase work capacity, broad time, multiple mains. I'm trying to make you a better version so that you can go out on the field and, you know, win, get a scholarship. Yeah. You know, we just, you know, last weekend, my athlete, Victor Hugo, you know, basically made history winning double gold at the IBJJF Worlds in jiu-jitsu. So he won the Open, won the heavy, and then last month he won the Brazilian Nationals, won the Open and the heavy, and first time in history somebody's won double gold at both of those. And, you know, had submissions in the final on both of the weight class and the Open. And, you know, that only happened like four times before in the last 27 years. I mean, just had an incredible dominant. Had like 6 out of 8 submissions and absolutely smashed people. And, you know, he, when he showed up, had zero strength conditioning, put him into the training program and, you know, fixed a lot of imbalances and some of the injuries and the things he'd been doing with, and just basically made him his best version. I mean, the kid busted his fucking ass. Those guys worked harder than I've ever expected anybody to, and were able to reap the benefits. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, like, whenever people want to talk about the training space or this, and, you know, I'm like, yeah, no, I mean, we figured it out, dude. I mean, like, you know, we bumbled, you know, bumped around with a flashlight in the early days, but in terms of like a clear defined program and to be able to make people better versions of themselves, man, we stamped that one out a long ago.
And you also have a cool set of data points coming in now, because you guys in the last handful of years also have created like the coaches program, where you guys are doing the training of coaches to go out and do the same. So you're getting also the things that they're seeing and coming back to you as well, which is like, even at that point, it just goes exponential in terms of what you guys are getting back to analyze and go from that point with.
Yeah. So the big piece for those guys is being able to present a case study where you've taken an athlete. You know, I was very fortunate to get a college scholarship. And that's an amazing deal, where obviously you don't have to worry about your school. You don't have student loans. So and any of my coaches that can take a kid, develop them, and have them go on into greatness. You know, we've had guys develop, you know, get kids in high school, get them college scholarships, and those kids go on and play in the NFL, professional sports, you know, Olympics. I mean, it's really, you know, the mark of a man isn't necessarily what he does in his life. It's how he affects those people around him. How big a rock can you throw and how many ripples? And I've just decided that, you know, obviously the A to B, you know, working with the athletes has been good, but really the education of coaches so that they can go out and use this methodology and this framework that we've developed over a number of years to influence and make best versions of those kids so that they have the greatest opportunities. To me, I think that's the mark and the success of the program.
Yeah, I would agree. And seeing it being able to translate so well coming from the guys that you taught, them being able to then teach it as well, like that's a different level of understanding as well. Because I mean, they say, you know, like, you don't really understand something until you can teach it. And then having guys that understand what you're saying, and now they can go teach the same thing. Because it's probably, you know, like a lot of them started as guys like myself, where we would do various blocks on the program or followed the power athlete programming forever. But it's like, if I want to coach this, I need to really understand it. And if I want to be able to teach it, I need to really understand where it came from and the very base level of it. And I want to kind of spin that into, because I want to know the story of, you guys have all these different programs available. And then the one that I mentioned earlier, that is the one that I like to do a few times a year, is Johnny Wad, which is like its own creature, like off to the side, that's not really like the same thing as the protocols for the rest of your stuff.
It's like we have like Johnny Watt's like the drunk uncle. He's not really in the family, but he shows up to the family events and usually gets hammered and causes trouble. You know, like the power athlete stuff is based off of, you know, the templates and really the training, like we talked about the PAP and the French contrast and, you know, the dynamic stuff and, you know, the different law specificity where we're looking to move through different movements and kind of based everything off of rep maxes and compensatory acceleration. And there's a lot of med ball throw. I mean, it's just, it's an athletic form of style of training. Johnny Watt is not. Johnny Watt is, bang 1 to 2 strength movements and then fucking set yourself on fire. And I write it on a different day. So like when we put out the programming, so this is really kind of the secret behind all this is so I start with a 6-week template and I know what I want to do over those 6 weeks. I load it and then like Saturday morning at like 5, 6 a.m. I get up and I like look at it fresh and I make changes on everything. And that's how that rolls. It's usually Friday night. I'll have like after we, if we go out or I'll have a drink, that's when I do the Johnny Watt stuff. And I usually just like laugh and, it doesn't like there's progression there isn't, but it's not, it's just heavy, hard and fast. It's supposed to be fun. Come lift some weights. It's like, I just always imagine like a couple dudes in the garage, like banging some weights and then just basically torching themselves. And, it's not predicated on like, you know, like a 3-to-1 push-pull ratio, step, squat, and lunge, and balance, and this. It's not predicated on all that. It's all about just like, hey, I want to use some funny sexual innuendos. I want to have some fun cycle names. I want to just fucking set myself on fire and get jacked. And it's real simple,
burn
man.
Burn the place down.
Yeah, and then, you know, we ended up writing this accessory program. It's called Johnny Bod. And it's just basically they kind of pair up together. You don't have to pair them up, but everybody does. And it's like, hey, here's what you do. And then here's just some straight up bodybuilding accessory, a lot of like foot stuff. So yeah. I became, fuck man, the year would have been like 1999. So I have high arches. And when I was playing in college, we were playing on turf and I was like blocking a dude and I went up on my toe and a guy landed on the back of my heel and I ended up having a mild Lisfranc. And so it wasn't complete. And normally with the Lisfranc, what they have to do is they have to go kind of stitch it back up and they pin the foot. If it doesn't, and the reason it's called Lisfranc is Lisfranc was the name of Napoleon's surgeon who figured it out because this would happen to guys in the cavalry and they just cut their foot off because the pain was too much. So Lisfranc figured out that if you pin the foot and did this, you could save the foot. So I had this mild Lisfranc and they would, before every practice and every game, they would just dump a bunch of like lidocaine and Novocaine in it and just kind of numb my foot because there was nothing they can do. They would tape it up real good and just send me out there. So when I went to the Eagles, first day, we're going through our physicals and I met a podiatrist named Lee Cohen. He looked at my x-rays and what had happened and said, hey, here's the deal. I'll either make you orthotics today and hope to God that they help, or let me show you how to take care of your feet. And I was like, well, let's go with the later. He's like, okay. You're not going to wear shoes anymore. I don't want you to wear shoes unless it's cold out. I want you to like no socks. Like if you got to wear, you know, because I wore Vans. So he's like Vans or flip flops or barefoot. And the only time I want you to wear shoes is on the football field. And I want you to show, I'm going to show you how to stretch and take care of your feet and all, you know, all the stuff that I did to kind of strengthen it. So that foot strengthening and the focus on my feet paid huge dividends because our contact with 99.999% of this earth is through our foot. And I cannot generate force in my body if my feet are weak. So I really believe, and I still do, and I believed it for, as you know, until I had this conversation almost 20 plus, over 20 years ago, that a weakness in the feet went up the chain into the hips and the back. That as long as I could keep my feet strong, I would avoid injury. Now I ended up having knee injuries, not because my feet were weak, but because fucking people fell in my knee. You know, I got a you know, dude fall in and this. I mean, so the contact injuries I've had for my knees have been, you know, I got real bad patellar tendonitis, running hurdles in high school. I mean, just some overtraining shit where it's just more based upon that. But like, you know, no hip and no back and, you know, some of the other issues because my feet were always so strong. And I, when I see athletes today and guys have a lot of these issues with back and the hips, I just go back to like, weak feet. And when I started working with those jiu-jitsu guys, even though you think they're barefoot all the time and this, I mean, their feet were weak in the fact that they could not generate force with plyometrics. So we saw a lot of force bleed, a lot of shake in the ankle, a lot of collapsing in this. So we started training barefoot, focusing a ton on the feet, found different ways to kind of attack it. And all of a sudden, They fixed the feet, up chain, everything else got strong. So just things like that where, and you hear people say it, and there's probably some weird guy on Instagram where his whole deal is the feet. But, you know, like in terms of a holistic style of training, you know, there's some stuff you can do with it. But, yeah, it was the NFL was an incredible proving ground. It's by far one of the greatest experiences of my life. And whenever I hear these ex-players be like, oh, if I had known the damage, I wouldn't have done. I'm like, fuck all that. You know, we're all going to die. Right. Certain people get to die sooner or some later. Some get scars, some don't. Some get to live bitching existence, others don't. And to say that you wouldn't have lived this existence because of now, you know, here you are looking at it 20 plus years later because you weren't able to manage the shit, just feels cowardice and feels dumb to me.
So was there, I want to ask about some of those guys that you play with. Was there any, because you were offensive lineman.
Yeah.
Was there anybody defensive lineman wise that will like, when you went up against, you're like, today's not going to be fun, basically, on a Sunday. Like, was there any of those kind of guys?
Yeah, every week. Every week was against the Hall of Famer and the best guy. And it's like, oh, this week is all pro, and this week's the future Hall of Famer, and this guy made the Pro Bowl. Like there's nowhere to hide. Like, there's never...
Who was the freakiest of all of them?
You know, I mean, I was fortunate to play against guys like Michael Strahan and, you know, Junior Seau. And, like, I mean, fuck, dude, I played against them all, so... you know, my only regret, and I was telling the story to somebody the other day, I was in a production meeting my second or third year in Philly, and Howie Long was in there, and we were going through this production thing, and he was asking me some questions, and I grew up in Southern California in the same town that he lived in when he was playing for the Raiders, and I told him, I was like, you know, I just have one regret in this life, and he was like, oh yeah, what is that? I'm like, well, that I was born too late because I would have fucking loved to play against you. And he was like, all of a sudden his whole demeanor changed, and you know how he's wearing glasses, he like takes his glasses off. And I was like, you know what, I watched you a ton, I think my style would have been really conducive towards you, and I think I would have fucking lit your ass up. His whole fucking demeanor changed, and like, oh yeah, I'm this. And I was like, all right, you know, right. So I always wanted to play against the best player on the biggest stage on their greatest day in front of the biggest crowd. Like, I'm a fan of humanity in this, and I think, you know, we had Joe Thomas on the podcast recently, who, you know, played for the Cleveland Browns and, you know, 10 years and or 11 years, and he ended up making the Hall of Fame. They never played on a winning season. He never saw anybody on their greatest day. And he actually said, I never wanted to see anybody on their greatest day. Like, whereas I wanted, you know, Monday Night Football in the playoff hunt against a future Hall of Famer who's fucking trying to set the single season sat record and trying to do this. And I want that dude on the biggest day in his moment, you know, fucking 3rd and 7 to win the game, and I want to fucking smash him. So I was always about, I want the biggest challenges on the biggest stage. So there was never a moment, like, I knew I had to get, have all my shit in one sock, to quote Uncle Dave Brewer. But, you know, I'd done the training. I'd prepared, I'd sharpened my blade, I'd done all the things that I needed to be successful. And I've always believed that if you prepare the way that you should and you've done the work, that all of a sudden when you get to go strap on the helmet and put on the game unis and go out there on a Sunday and run out, like, you have nervous energy to get the fight, but like, you're not scared to do the fight. And I've never viewed as anybody as insurmountable. The other regret, I didn't get a chance to play against J.J. Watt. I would have liked to play against him. Played a lot against a lot of Hall of Famers, a lot of great ones, and was always, you know, very successful. So
where do you sit on the idea? Because this is like one of the all-time oldest sports arguments ever, is like, what would this guy do if he played in this time period, right? You know, and it happens in football, happens in, you know, it happens in every sport.
Sure.
And it's like, oh, if LeBron was playing back in the 60s, he would have been Wilt Chamberlain times 100 or what, you know, whatever it is. Like, the guys that you played with and when you were playing, like, how do you think they – I mean, are they the same guys, the best at that time, if they're in this league right now?
Yeah, hands down.
People
keep talking about, oh, the game has, these guys have gotten bigger and stronger, and, you know, the no. The reason that it has is because they've taken the load out of practice. So when I went to training camp my rookie year, we were in training camp for 42 days. We had a buy-in training camp. We were 3 hours in the morning, pads, 3 hours in the afternoon in pads, 3 hours in the morning, the next day in pads, then we had special teams practice. We held that for 42 days. The amount of hitting that Dick Vermeil did in just 2 days is probably more than most players will see in an entire season, including practice in the games.
Wow.
So just the baton death march, the cadence, just what physically you had to go through to even get to your first game was more hitting than these kids today or the guys in the NFL today will see during an entire career. They get like five padded practices and then what, like 16 games? So they really get about, let's say, 21 legit days. That was that was literally like 10 days of training camp to us.
Quarter of the way through before the season like, even started.
Yeah, like, I mean, dude, we did 9-on-7, 1-on-1, inside, one, you know, all of these things. Fuck, they don't do that anymore. So when you talk about the guys are getting bigger and they're stronger and they're moving faster, it's just the fact that they don't have the load. They can be bigger. They can be stronger. They can. And I don't know if a lot of the players would be physically tough enough to be able to go through that. That piece, you know, I played in kind of the two eras. At the beginning was kind of this, like, you know, fucking tough guy football deal. And then, you know, towards the end of my career, obviously that changed. And it was just a very, very different. So it's not that the NFL or the players have changed and everything. It's just that the NFL has changed. The game has changed. And they've effectively neutered it. So it allows for bigger, stronger, faster, healthier dudes. I mean, we used to have guys that would get hurt and then come back a few weeks, you know, without missing, you know, without practicing. And we'd always tell those dudes, be like, you got to watch out. You're going to get fucking hurt just for the mere fact that, like, you haven't physically taken this. Now you're taking teams of this and these reduced practice schedules and these guys are doing shells all the time. Of course they can go out there and kill it on Sunday. They're not beat up. So
how far back do you think you can go and bring somebody here and that still applies? Like, you know, the guy, I mean, like, are you taking guys from the 80s and the 70s still and thinking they can pull that off?
Oh, now shit. I think a Dick Butkus is still, whatever era you put him in, Dick Butkus is still going to be a savage. I think, you know, you take a Reggie White, and I don't care what generation you put the Reverend in, Reggie White's still going to do it. You look at Strahan, you look at a lot of these dudes, like a Howie Long, these guys, if you put them in this system. You know, they talk about, you know, Donaldson, you know, the D tackle for the Rams, 99, you know, being the dude, I don't know, he probably would have backed up Howie Long.
Yeah.
So, I mean, not to say he's not a great player in this, and they call these different eras, and these, no, like, there were dudes.
It hands, translates across hands the down. Generations yeah. of it.
No, it hands down. I have no doubt. I mean, if, you know, I could step into a time machine and, you know, all of a sudden be 20 years younger, could I go out there and say, yes, 100%. And still fucking kill those dudes.
The only sport that I think, and maybe I don't know, because
Wilt Chamberlain. If you put Wilt Chamberlain today, okay, yeah. it would be different because everybody's right. like that. I mean, he was so dominant because there was just like. But I mean, dude, you look at like Jerry West. I mean, you look at Larry Bird. I mean, you know, I mean, think about like Michael Jordan and Larry Bird and those guys playing. Like they could take, like they could tic tac, they could hit. Those guys were physical.
Yeah.
Now today, fucking, you breathe on LeBron and he has a fucking heart attack. You know, could he have played in that era? Yeah, 100% he could have, because he would have, that's just how they played. So, I mean, people adjust to their era. You know, baseball, I don't know about baseball. I'm not a huge baseball, like, lover of folklore and this, and could this guy have played? But I know in football, the training today is so much more specialized, and guys have really figured it out. Like I think when I came in the NFL, there were guys that understood it, and there were people that knew, and there were a lot of guys that didn't. And I think today that the application and the information, just because of the internet, I'll tell you this, I'm friends with Derek Woodsky and Adam Nelson and some of these guys, you know, gold medalists and some of these amazing dudes. And, you know, sitting around, Adam Nelson's telling a story of when he squatted like 585 for like 10 reps or something. And Woodsky, like, I mean, just this, like, amazing shit. And my biggest regret was if I knew that these guys were out there doing it and I'd seen it on social media, I would have fucking DM'd them and been like, where are you? Like, send me an address. I'll be there tomorrow. If there's somebody training hard in me and doing better and I knew about it, I would have fucking gone and found them. Probably the same thing for girls, too. I mean, like, when I was in the NFL, like it was New York Model Week, or we go to Miami for Model Week, because you had to like go places where there were like these uber hot chicks. Now with social media, I'd be like, I'd just be like, hey, what are you doing? I'll send you a plane ticket. Like, let's meet somewhere. You know, it'd be so. Oh my God, I would like. We wouldn't have to go to Model Week. I'd have models coming to me all the time. So, like, you legitimately had to go out and, you know, walk up and talk to people. There was no dating apps or social media. I mean, you know, we go to Model Week and you're over there trying to, you know, pull some girl off of the runway and just buy her a drink and talk to her and actually had to have some game. A post from now, it's like me slipping a DM. I was like, fuck, this has made people so fucking lazy. No wonder I can get up there and talk. I mean, these other people are like, ooh, seriously. I can send a DM. Oh, boy.
You know? The Jordan example is funny. Made me think of, it was just recently, because I think it was the year that LeBron and the Lakers had won the title a couple years back. And somebody had asked Michael in an interview, they said, where do you think your best Bulls team, you know, would you guys compare and beat this Lakers team right now if you played today? And he said, I think we'd probably win by 2 or 3 points. And the person goes, really, that's it? Like, that's all? Why so close of a game? And the answer is, he goes, well, all of us are almost 60 now, so.
Well, I mean, the stories are pretty good about when Jordan, you know, was working at Charlotte. He would go out and play against those kids and absolutely light them the fuck up, to the point where they asked him to stop playing with the kids because it was hurting their confidence. And he was in his 40s and 50s out there just raining fucking fire on them. So, you know, you know, and I'm sure there'll be sportsmen. You know, I'm just telling you, dude. Big and strong is big and strong, and I played against big and strong dudes, and I've been a big and strong dude myself. I mean, I benched 580, or what was it, 535 for a triple. Watched a guy not lift weights for 6 months and come in and bench 550 for a fast five. I mean, I watched genetic freaks do freaky things. I mean, Willie Rofe would still be, you know, Willie Rofe in the Hall of Fame and be the best to ever do it. Tony Gonzalez is still going to be the best. And it's even funnier when people are like, oh, he's the best tight end and Tony's name isn't in there. I'm like, are you guys out of your mind? You guys are going to put Gronk over him? I'm like, you know, I mean, just, yeah, I mean, there's always going to be, and people always think that their era is the best, but there's certain players that are stalwarts in this deal that, you know, Howie Long will always be Howie Long. And, you know, the only reason, you know, he weighed 275, the only reason he didn't weigh 295 was there weren't 295, 300-pound offensive linemen. The biggest dudes were like 275, 280, and he was their size. And he even said it. He goes, fuck, all you guys are 300 pounds. I would have been 300 pounds, too, and I still would have been killing you guys. And I'm like, bring it, motherfucker. So I was very fortunate, you know, to grow up. And, you know, I always wanted to lift weights and the physical culture piece. And I was very fortunate when I went in, and I was mentored very early on by a guy named George Zangis. And we went in and lifted weights, and I had some great training partners. Whenever we went and trained, we got stronger. You know, I didn't let small setbacks, you know, the coach doesn't like me or this get in my way. And I just had this vision that I could be something better than what I am. And I knew that, like, I remember I told my dad used to make fun of me. And he thought that lifting weights was stupid, that morons lift weights. It's just counting to 10 over and over again. And it doesn't take any brain power. And I told him, like, Dad, this lifting weights thing is, it's important to me and I want to do it. And he's like, morons do it. So I remember I signed a new contract and I bought him a black twin turbo Porsche. And I remember we were sitting at dinner and I slid the keys over at him. I was like, lifting weights, just bought you a fucking brand new twin turbo Porsche. This is what morons do. And he was like, yeah, he didn't say anything. He's like, yeah, well, occasionally people are wrong about some shit.
Right. That's hilarious. I want to, as we start to kind of close down a little bit, I wanted to kind of shift gears because there's a couple of, like I mentioned earlier, some pop culture stuff I want to talk, because it's one of my favorite like tangents you guys always go on the podcast. And there was one from, I can't even remember how long ago it was, and the conversation was about like what was the best year of action movies.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like, is it 85 or was it 92 or 94 or whatever. So like, I know you've got your opinion there, so I want to hear what you think it is. And then I also want to do the same thing on music. Like, if there was a singular year that you think was like the year that all the best stuff, like that year holds up against what came out that year against any others.
Oh, I do. So I think it was 85 was the year I selected, and I can't remember if that's what it came. Was it 85? I can't remember.
That was Rambo, right?
Yeah.
That
was, like, what the, how the argument figured out. But like, you know, I mean, I think whatever, like, whatever time you kind of grew up in is kind of like the most impactful. And for me, there was like a, you know, a bunch of movies that were in that 85 deal that just like, you know, were so impactful. One of them was like Weird Science, you know, The Heavenly Kid, Better Off Dead, Teen Wolf. I mean, just like so many, like The Legend of Billie Jean was another 80s movie. I'm like looking at some of these. Real Genius came out in 85. Like the Goonies. I mean, people are probably like, I've never seen these movies. The Breakfast Club, St. Elmo's Fire, Summer Rental. Like,
it's a strong year.
Oh my God. Like, like this is like nothing but the hits. I mean, and like, you know, Mad Max came out that year. Commando came out that year. Barry Gordy's The Last Dragon, which for those of you guys that have never seen it, is probably my top three favorite movies. So,
okay.
I got into martial arts when I was six. So early 80s, my older brother got beat up by some local bully. My dad wasn't a fighter, takes my brother down to the local dojo. You know, it's Japanese martial arts, karate, Shotokan deal. And about 3 weeks after my brother came home, was like working on his punches and kicks on us, my dad just dropped us all off. And I did that. So like was pretty deep into like martial arts and like I like got super obsessed. 85, I'm still doing martial arts. This movie, Barry Gordy's Last Dragon, comes out. And for those of you guys that have seen it, it's fucking great. It's like show enough. It's like one of the best movies. So I remember sitting and like watching. I remember, did we see it at the movie theater? Yeah, I think we saw it in the movie theater and just being like, oh my God, this is us. And then I remember the next year, I was in 86. I saw Marvin Hagler fight Tommy Hearns on TV, and they just basically, these two jack dudes in like short shorts stood in the middle of the ring toe to toe and fucking threw bombs for three rounds. And I remember at that point, martial arts was dead and I wanted to box. So
that's all I wanted. Yep.
Yeah. But Cocoon that's came out that one. Movie or that, oh, that year. What else came out? Back to the Future. There was like so many, Legend.
There's so many. My yeah. pick, I think I'd go 94. Because that was
Forrest Gump,
Shawshank.
Which is the other best year in like, The Crow came out, which was another great movie. Interview with the Vampire. I was super
True Lies.
I was super obsessed with all the Anne Rice books when I was in college. Yep. So, I went to Berkeley. This is so random. I used to like we were so as a scholarship football player, my scholarship check was $740. And my rent was like $475, so we were fucking super broke. And I ended up getting a job working security for illegal raves in San Francisco. And it was they would pay $300, which to me might as well have been $1 million. And I ended up working with the security crew, and we would periodically get booked to work security at this club for the Vampire Society of San Francisco. And it was some freaky shit, man. These people had these like stainless steel teeth, and they would go over and they would fucking pay people to bite them, and it was super wacky. And so we'd work security, and so I got super into like the Anne Rice kind of vampire books just because I was around all these weirdos. But yeah, so that would have been 84 or 94. The Crow, Witchcraft, The Mask,
Natural Born Killers.
Oh my God, dude.
It was 94. Dude. Also, Jim Carrey had The Mask, Ace Ventura, and Dumb and Dumber all in 1994.
But Legends of the Fall,
Legends of the Fall
is another one. Natural Born Killer. Crazy. Pulp Fiction. To this day,
Pulp Fiction.
I can still remember sitting in the movie theater watching Pulp Fiction with my girlfriend and one of my teammates and realizing to this day, still one of my favorite movies. Reality Bites, 8 Seconds. What else?
Some good ones, man. It's crazy. Like the density. In those two years alone.
Clear and Present Danger.
Clear and Present Danger.
What else?
Solid.
Dude, there's some other good ones.
Lion King. That was the one I didn't know was 94.
Yeah. What else? Oh, yeah, dude. It's just. This was like an argument, and I kind of like on the podcast. I mean, Wyatt Earp was another one. Shit, for Westerns. Yeah. So that argument kind of stemmed. True Lies was also in there, dude. Ace Ventura, The Mask. Wow. So both two amazing years, and yes. I just had to pick one, and I went with the 80s. But I mean, really, the Pulp Fiction and The Crow, which to this day still is one of my favorite movies. I still have that soundtrack.
So good.
Yeah, these are great. And Natural Born Killers, when he turns to the camera and he goes, I guess I'm just a natural born killer, and then the whole place riots.
Yeah.
And like, what was it, Robert Downey Jr. is like, and he's kind of playing that like reporter guy. Yep. Next thing you know, he's got like a headband on and he's out there with a gun taking him. It's the best. I mean, Juliette Lewis was at her hottest. Woody Harrelson was at his best. I mean, those were great movies.
The only other year that I had as like even I think would compare, because I mean this, and like you said, it depended on how old you were at the time, right? Like where you were when you grew up. 99, I think, was right up there. That was Fight Club, Matrix, oh. Sixth Sense.
I
10 Things I Hate About You. Like, I mean, there was Green Mile. There were so many good ones.
I was in college when The Matrix came out. And mm-hmm. I remember we were down in Berkeley. I went to go see it with Iago Williams. And, like, we saw that movie. And, like, the world changed.
Yeah.
That was, like, one of those, like, life-changing moments. But, like, The End of Days was in there in 99. Mm-hmm. What else? Boondock Saints. Best movies ever. yeah. I love that movie. Oh, yeah. There's so many good movies.
American Beauty was 99, too. There's some good ones.
Oh, man. Yeah. That's right. That's right. America. I mean, 99 is another. It's pretty wild how they hit these peaks, and you're like, shit.
Yeah.
This is, Midnight.
Fun rabbit holes.
Yeah, The Green Mile. Wow. And she's all that. Man. These are all great 99 movies. Cruel Intentions was in there. These are all good movies. Yeah. No, I don't know if you can really pick. So
I know it's impossible.
We did, and we argued just for the podcast, but these movies are as impactful to me today as they always were. So I go with that 85 just because of Weird Science and some of the movies I remember seeing when I was a kid with my brother, and yeah, it was great. But there was one year for music that is probably for me personally, like I wasn't around when Led Zeppelin came out, but like 1991 right. was probably the best movie year, album year. Like 91 was huge. So you got to remember in like 91, obviously that was when Nirvana, Smells Like Teen Spirit comes out.
Yep.
And I think, what are the other ones? Let me pull these up.
I think that was when 10 came out too.
Yeah, it was 10. Was 10. Metallica's Black Album.
Yep.
Blood Sugar Sex Magic by the Red Peppers. Red Hot Chili Peppers. Ozzy's No More Tears.
Oh, that's a good one.
What else?
91 solid choice. I would have picked something in the early 90s. I couldn't remember if it was 91 or 92 that a lot of those came out. But if it's 91, then I'll probably do that one too.
Dude, yeah, 91 was like, I remember I was in high school. I think I was a freshman in high school. And I had remembered all the 80s hair bands. And then all of a sudden, like MTV, I remember we'd come home, watch MTV, and we saw Nirvana Smells Like Teen Spirit. And it was as if like a lightning bolt just hit music, and like the grunge era started, and all of a sudden dudes in high heels and leather and lipstick and all that just like fucking dissipated, man. And all the whole thing went away, you know?
I love it, dude. Oh man. I'm glad we got to cover that stuff. Yeah. That was where I wanted to get to a couple of that. Well, man, John, I really appreciate you making time and getting to chat. I've been looking forward to it for a while. So
yeah. Well, thank you for having me. And I always love rapping a little bit about the history of CrossFit football and then talking movies. So this is perfect for me. I have a great day doing this forever. So thank you for having me.
Awesome. Of course, man. And you want to throw out where everybody's finding all the Power Athlete stuff for links and stuff?
Yeah, we're super easy to find on social media. It's at John Wellborn, at Power Athlete Inc. on Instagram. And the website is just powerathletehq.com. If you put in John Wellborn or Power Athlete, like, we're really easy to find. So if you're looking for us, which is funny because people send me emails, I'm like, dude, I'm so easy to find. Just enter the Google stuff and
quick search.
Yeah, Power Athlete Radio, 700 episodes. We're on Spotify and anywhere else you can kind of digest podcasts. So if you're looking for strength conditioning information, training programs, on all the other stuff, man, we got a ton of it. So we've been doing this a long time.
Awesome. Well, thanks again, John. I really appreciate it, man.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's time to get your checking account to zero with free checking from PenFed. That's zero ATM fees, zero balance requirements, and zero time spent waiting for your paycheck to direct deposit because you can receive it up to 2 days early. Open your account with just $25 and see how big zero can be. Apply online today at PenFed.org/free checking. Early direct deposit eligibility may vary between pay periods and timing of payer's funding. To receive any advertised product, you must become a member of PenFed, insured by NCUA. PenFed's got great rates.